Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your guest host for this episode, Dr. Doug Ray from Baltimore, Maryland. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Eugene Chang. Dr. Chang is a professor of otolaryngology and the director of the Division of Neurorhinology at the University of Arizona. We'll be discussing his recent publication, a prospective longitudinal study assessing the impact of rhinovirus and bacterial infection in acute exacerbations of chronic sinusitis that was just published in the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. So Eugene, thanks so much for joining me on this beautiful fall evening. How are things at the University of Arizona?
Well, Doug, again, thanks again for the invitation. Things are really good. We are finally cooling down, so it doesn't feel like fall yet here, but we are finally going from the triple digits to the double digits. And it's exciting. The weather's getting nicer. As you know, Tucson, Arizona is a big college town with the university. So students are back in session. We have a fantastic group of faculty that I get to work with. As rhinologists, Dr. Chris Lay is my wonderful and active rhinology and skull-based partner. And then we also had Dr. Richard Orlandi join us. He's now our new CEO of our hospital, but we have the added advantage that he's a fantastic rhinologist, so he's going to join our division. And then, of course, we've got our wonderful residents as well as fellows. So always good to be back in session and back in town.
And you have a wonderful department and a great rhinology division, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So I'm going to give like just a little bit of a background for the listeners, and then we'll kind of jump right into it. We know that acute exacerbations are common in patients with chronic sinusitis, and they can have a pretty significant impact on their quality of life. They also have a negative impact in terms of a negative economic impact in terms of days of work missed. They have an effect on people's overall health because these patients typically have to go to the doctor and they require treatment with antibiotics and oral steroids. So in the past, most studies that have looked at these acute exacerbations have been limited as their retrospective studies, but this is the first one, and you can correct me, but in looking in my review of the literature, this looks to be the first study that I could find that's actually a prospective study that looks at exacerbations in chronic sinusitis in a longitudinal fashion. Your study looked at quality of life scores in these patients with acute exacerbations and also looked at the presence of rhinovirus and bacterial infections. So Eugene, we all know the sort of course of chronic sinusitis is typically a waxing and waning course in terms of the inflammation and also the patient's symptoms. And we've learned that like other airway disease, such as asthma, that our management of the disease, part of the milestones we can use or ways we can tell if we're doing well in terms of the control of the disease is sort of how we manage the frequency and the degrees of these exacerbations and their flare-up of the disease. So first, tell me, how did you get interested in the topic?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think you're right. When we did a literature search, we didn't see many prospective studies, but I think it's really important because the C in CRS stands for chronic, right? And so when we first meet our patients, I'm very frank with them, and I tell them that we will probably be friends, hopefully, for a long time because their disease does wax and wane. And so when patients come in to see us, just like, you know, my own experience as a patient, I never see a doctor until I absolutely have to. And that's because, you know, we're busy, we have active lives, and as long as our health is doing fine, we don't really seek medical care. But when patients come in to see us, they can't smell, they're having difficulty sleeping, they're missing work, they're having to take some time off, and they just feel overall pretty miserable. And so this can be a waxing and waning symptom, just like you had mentioned. And it got me really interested in trying to determine what causes patients to come in to see physicians, and then what can we do to kind of help patients through these times of exacerbations where their symptoms do worsen. In terms of what got me interested in the topic, you know, for us, we're kind of outcomes people, right? So when patients come to us and they say, hey, I can't smell or I feel miserable, we try and affect the end outcome. We might do surgery, we might treat them with medications. But I was always curious in terms of why. And so I always asked them when their sinus symptoms started. And for many of the people that I've talked to, they will kind of describe this story where they'll say, you know, it was during like Thanksgiving, all the family got together. One aunt was sick and she got all of us sick. My wife, my daughter, my kids also got sick. But then after a couple of days, they got better. But for me, you know, it's been prolonged and now it's September and I'm coming in to see you. And so they've been living with this for months. So I always wanted to know, what started this whole thing? And then why did this person have a worsening symptom and a prolonged duration of symptoms as opposed to maybe their other members of the family where they had this, you know, a viral infection and they got over things? So that's what really drew me to this aspect of the study, as well as the patients that we typically see.
Yeah. So it's sort of like trying to figure out why these patients are getting worse, and which will sort of lead to us to help sort of better manage that. So talk a little bit about your paper's methodology.
Absolutely. So what we did was we followed patients kind of from when they first came in through the door. We obviously enrolled them in a research study and kind of talked to them about what we were trying to do. And what we really wanted to do is we wanted to define what an exacerbation was and to be able to time it so that way we could identify when their exacerbations were occurring. And then also take a look in their nose and examine them and see what might be driving these exacerbations. So as you can imagine, prospective studies take a lot of time. They take a lot of effort. And this really couldn't have been done without my excellent clinical research coordinator, Dr. Narushin Narendran, who is a primary author. But what we did was we did subjective and objective outcomes, including symptom scores, including nasal endoscopy when we first saw them. And then every 2 weeks, we would send questionnaires, we would call them, we would text them, and we'd say, check in with them and say, how are you doing? You know, are you feeling well? Fantastic. If they were feeling well, then we'd call them or text message them the next 2 weeks. If they weren't feeling well, we would offer them a visit to be seen within our clinic so that we could identify what might be going on and what they look like and how poorly they were feeling. It's important to know how patients are feeling, but obviously if we can identify risk factors, that would be important. And so we also would brush their nose for any potential viruses. My lab focuses on rhinovirus, so that's what we focus on. And then we would take a look and see how they were feeling. And then objectively, we would take a look in their nose and see if they had purulent mucus, if they had tissue edema, if they had anything that might be able to explain what caused their increase in symptoms.
So were these patients coming in regularly every 2 weeks, or you were only monitoring their symptoms? And then if there was a criteria, you'd have them come in. I know this, but I'm just for the listeners. How did you decide you were going to have someone come in to take a look at them? And how did you define acute exacerbation?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we had patients being seen every 2 weeks, it would pretty much overwhelm us as well as our clinical team. And so we didn't do that. What we would do is we would ask them through a worse questionnaire. So the worse is actually a validated symptom score that's typically used for upper respiratory infections. And for us, it was perfect because a lot of the questions that they asked were very similar to sinonasal symptoms. But essentially, if they had a score of greater than one, so essentially if they were complaining of sinonasal symptoms worse than they were at the time when we contacted them compared to their baseline, then we would call them and we would bring them in. So of the 80 patients that we followed for a year, so every two weeks we were contacting them, about half of them did come in for a clinical visit, which we diagnosed as then an acute exacerbation for chronic sinus disease.
Actually, just to go back real quick, you used the worst score, but you also used, in addition, it's not 22, correct?
Absolutely. So we wanted to validate the use of worse as a potential method to look at exacerbations. So we looked at both worse as well as SNOT 22. And we talk about MCID or mean clinical differences in terms of what the big changes are. You know, SNOT 22 can vary depending on the time of day that you take it. But for us, we required an MCID of greater than 9, which has been validated from researchers to be a clinically important difference. And so that, in conjunction, both of those essentially gave us a validated reason to say, look, yes, it does sound like you are getting sick or you are having an exacerbation. Why don't you come in and we'll take a look at you?
Yeah. And first of all, I just want to congratulate you because you had 80 patients enrolled, and that's pretty incredible given the fact that you were checking in with them every couple of weeks and 80 patients over a 1 year period. I think you said the length of the total study was about 2.5 years, but that's a lot of patients to look at. So first of all, congratulations on getting that many patients into the study. So like you mentioned, half of the patients had an exacerbation. So talk a little bit about when you called them, their worst score was greater than one, their SNOT 22 was greater than nine. You call them, you swab them for RV. How did you decide whether you were going to get a bacterial culture or not?
So our main indicator for getting a bacterial culture was to take a look in their nose and see if they had purulent mucus that we could identify. I think that's important because what we've shown and others as well is that you can swab a nose that's where somebody's feeling totally fine without any mucus, and you might be able to identify some bacteria that could be commensal or not important. And so for us, this constellation of increasing symptoms as well as visible purulent mucus that we could culture was important. And so many of the patients that we did see actually did have purulent mucus, which again, kind of validated our definition of AECRS. And then many of them also did have rhinovirus type infections.
And so I think there were some also other really interesting things that you saw in your study. One of them was that the mean SNOT 22 scores. So you're contacting these patients and recording their quality of life scores on a regular basis. And then the mean SNOT 22 scores were overall higher in the fall and winter months. And there was also corresponding with that a higher incidence of acute exacerbations during that time. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we were excited about this because this actually validated a lot of the work that had been performed by the Mayo Clinic earlier. And the Mayo Clinic, what they did was they looked at databases, so overall databases of people who were being seen in their clinics for exacerbations for sinus disease. And they found this bump in the fall and the winter, and they speculated, you know, it certainly could be related to viral infections. But that was more observational clinical data, right? And so for us, when we were bringing these patients in, we were seeing this in real time. And we were seeing this in real time when we were querying them every 2 weeks. And so we saw this big bump in the fall and the winter. And we think it's probably related to a couple of things. One is there's a predominance of viral infections during that time. Obviously, for us as well, there's a higher congregation of people that kind of congregate. So this is right when school starts, daycare, all of those types of risk factors for infections as well. And then we do see from seasonal variations, a higher rate of viruses such as rhinovirus as well as influenza during these times.
Yeah. So then you took these patients, they came in, they got cultures and either a viral swab or a bacterial culture. And what you found was that there was a strong correlation. You found that 8 of the patients that had an exacerbation had a culture that was positive for a rhinovirus. And then half of the patients, 17 of the 35 that had exacerbations had also a concurrent bacterial infection. Either I think that the bacteria that was most predominant was Staph aureus or Pseudomonas in that order. And that 7 of the 8 patients with rhinovirus also had a positive culture for a bacterial infection. So tell us a little bit about kind of what we can take from those results.
Yeah, I will spin it a little bit in terms of kind of a question back to the audience. I think when we treat patients for sinus disease, at the end of the surgery, we flush things out, we've irrigated them, we've cleaned them out, we've opened up all the sinus passageways. And for a while, things look pretty clean. But there are times when they'll come in with purulent mucus, bacterial infections, increasing symptoms. And we always wondered, you know, what set this off? And so this article doesn't answer that question per se, but it does give us some hints. What I suspect is going on is that there is this increase in viral infections. It triggers an immune response within the patient's immune system, and that likely then correlates to a change that encourages bacterial infections to proliferate, whether that be increased mucus due to, you know, trying to clear out the virus with mucociliary clearance, whether that be a type 1 to type 2 immune response shift that we've seen for some of our rhinovirus species, whether that be a change in the microbiome, which others have also been able to look at in terms of pre-virus versus post-virus, or even just changes regarding inflammation. This kind of helps us to kind of understand what might those triggers be that bring these patients into our clinics and that we do end up culturing and then we do end up treating with antibiotics. And hopefully some of this information in the future might help us to determine who needs medical therapy. Are there a certain subset of patients that we want to treat with antibiotics? Are there ones that we don't want to treat with antibiotics? And how can we distinguish between those two groups?
That makes perfect sense. So Eugene, to play a little bit of a devil's advocate, we had talked about the fact that overall, SNOT 22 scores for your patients in this study were higher in the fall and winter, and there was also a corresponding increase in exacerbations. It's sort of like a chicken and egg phenomenon in the sense that is it possible that there's an underlying higher level of inflammation in these patients during certain periods of time with sort of the natural course of the disease, as we describe it, sort of waxes and wanes. And so in the fall and winter, they have higher rates of inflammation that predispose them to having these exacerbations and getting infections, or is it the infections that's driving the process? You may not have an answer, but what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. We are starting to look at that based on culture systems, right? So we can control what we can modulate in cultures, but even with the best follow-up for our patients, we can't really control, you know, are they stopping their nasal spray? Are they being at a higher rate for allergic type responses? Are they not irrigating or rinsing? And so you're right, it is a chicken and egg. But what I suspect is that we have to think about what the drivers of inflammation are. I will say that nasal steroid sprays probably don't do a great job of controlling inflammation. And so by somebody stopping a nasal spray for a week or two, I don't think it would drive higher level of inflammation around that time. So I don't think it's patient treatment driven. I do suspect that it is something exogenous, whether it be viruses, bacteria, or even allergens that might play a role to drive inflammation within the nose and within the sinuses.
And so that actually kind of leads into my next question, which is another factor that I'm not sure if you considered or may consider going forward. But as you had mentioned, when you meet a sinus patient, one of the reasons why we love being sinus doctors is that really a patient is a patient for life, right? Because this is a chronic disease. And even if we're doing surgery, I tell all my patients at the minimum, you're probably going to be seeing me once a year forever, unless you move away. So we know that our success in controlling the disease is patient compliant. One of the huge portions or factors in the success of the way we manage successfully this disease is patient compliance. Did you think a little bit about looking at that in terms of monitoring your patients, in terms of are they compliant with their daily medications and what medications are they on? Are they, as you mentioned, are they just using a topical nasal steroid? Or are they using steroid irrigations? Are they using a steroid delivery system? Because we all know that sort of that's important in controlling their chronic inflammation. Have you thought about looking at that?
Yeah, we did. So we would always, you know, give our recommendations, right? So sinus nasal irrigations, usually with budesonide, particularly for my type 2 inflammatory patients, are kind of my go-to. But we know that patient compliance is challenging. I always tell my patients to keep their irrigation bottle right next to their toothbrush. But, you know, who knows how many times they actually brush or how many times they irrigate.
By the way, I say the same thing and then I look at the patient's teeth.
But, you know, is there a way that we can measure that? Probably there is some fancy way. You know, we could look at counters for, you know, how many times the irrigation bottle is used or how many times it's suspended or raised. But at the end of the day, we do need to trust our patients to be able to do that. And I always stress the importance of that. I don't think if it was due to compliance alone that we would see the seasonal variation. And I think that, you know, that kind of makes me think it's probably part of the picture. Obviously, people get tired of, you know, kind of prolonged care, but it's probably not all of the picture.
So I think, you know, going forward, another potential in future studies is sort of at least to track, you know, are you doing your, you know, but then again, you're relying on the patients being honest with you because we're sort of like their school teachers. They just want to tell us what we want to hear.
Exactly. Because often I'll be like, hey, are you doing your irrigations? And they'll say, yes. And they say, I say twice a day. And they're like, once 3 days? And I said, so
yeah,
once a week.
Exactly.
And they're like, yes, yeah, once a week.
Yeah, exactly. So taking all that we've discussed and sort of what you found in this study, any ideas as to, for all of us who are treating these patients, potential opportunities in terms of the way we manage them, interventions or things that we can do to reduce these exacerbations, the frequency and the severity of these exacerbations?
Yeah, so I will give you a story about what we saw during COVID. And so during COVID, everybody was in a panic, of course. Many people were staying at home and it was a scary time. And people were very diligent about all the things that we tell patients, right? You know, washing their hands, close hygiene or careful hygiene, minimizing close contacts. And I was following the influenza tracker really closely. In Arizona, all influenza positive infections are recorded through the state. And the reason why I was looking at this was because we were really concerned with, based on some of the scientific data that our lab had produced, was that there was going to be this synergistic effect when you had a viral infection with COVID that would make things actually amplified. And so that was part of one of our research projects. But what we found, which was really interesting, and which was mirrored really all across the country and the world, was that during these times when people were being very, very careful about hygiene, all those viral infections and the serious ones dropped significantly. And so if you look at the virus tracker, they took a huge nosedive. And it's because people were listening to kind of things that are relatively common sense, right? Like washing your hands with soap, you know, keeping your hands and fingers away from your noses and your eyes, if you can, and kind of minimizing or at least cleaning yourself after kind of personal contact. And so I think that that's probably the first thing that we can learn. And it was a nice reminder, although, you know, we see a drop off in this effect as we move further and further away from that scary time. Now, influenza rates are incredibly high. Rhinovirus rates are also incredibly high. So that was a gentle reminder that we can be proactive in this. If we think about, let's say, antiviral and antibacterial therapies, sure. I mean, those are things that we can address and impact early, but they've got some pretty significant side effects. And so what we would ideally do is we would ideally find a high-risk group that really might be able to benefit from intensive therapy. And if we could treat them early, then we could actually hopefully prevent the progression of disease for something like chronic sinus disease, where we see a lot of airway remodeling. And so our lab is actually looking at that and seeing if there's some potential genetic risk factors that might be moving forward, or some environmental exposures that might predispose people to kind of this track where they do get these chronic infections.
Is the rate of rhinovirus and flu and those types of issues higher in Arizona than they are in the other parts of the country, say in the Northeast?
Yeah, that's a great question. Ben Blair had this really cool study where he looked at cold and weather and the potential indication for that and why that might be important in seasonal variations across the country. I don't think that that's the case. So people have always said that Arizona would be a perfect place to retire if you had asthma, allergies, or sinus infections. And I will tell you personally that I see a lot of patients with asthma, allergy, and sinus infections that have actually gotten worse by moving to the desert.
And so it doesn't protect you from those potential, as you've shown in the study, the potential flare-ups or exacerbations you can get caused by rhinovirus or bacterial infections in the fall and winter.
Right. Yeah. I don't think it's temperature related per se. I think it's environmental specific. I think it's genetic. I think it's kind of how you were raised. And there's a lot of good evidence about that in terms of risk factors in young life. So I think that would be important to look at from a precision medicine standpoint. I also would like to throw out, and this is interesting to me, I don't know what the correlation is yet, but there was an ad hoc study that looked at actually biologic therapies, and they looked and they thought, well, you know, do biologic therapies in sinus disease, do they reduce infections? And this was done kind of in a messy fashion. They again looked at kind of database studies, but they actually did find a reduction. So I think if we can control inflammation, and that doesn't have to be through a biologic, it could be through, just like you had mentioned, you know, high compliance with sinonasal irrigations with steroids, whether it be through the irrigations or through it be powder or through sprays, controlling that trigger might be able to reduce the exacerbations. Because we do think of exacerbations as kind of like an elevator. You know, you're slowly going to go up, but there's going to be something that's going to jar things, and then you're going to rapidly become symptomatic. So by turning down the volume of the inflammation, perhaps we can reduce the acute exacerbations that drive people to our clinics and also drive people to, you know, surgery. Or medical therapy.
And wash your hands and use a mask when you're flying in the fall and winter, or you're out of the store in the fall and winter.
Exactly.
Well, Eugene, this was an excellent discussion. I really appreciate you joining me tonight. I think your paper provides a lot of interesting insights into sort of what could be driving these exacerbations and potentially helping us help our patients with chronic sinusitis deal with these sort of flare-ups of their disease and getting them under better control. So I really want to congratulate you and your fellow authors on your publication.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate the International Forum for Allergy and Rhinology. It's one of our favorite journals to disseminate this information. So if there's anything we can do to help you folks, we'd be happy to. And if folks have further questions, feel free to reach out to me as well. Thanks again, Doug.
Thank you, Eugene. And thank you to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Doug Ray for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm signing off for now. Take care.